Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much will conscientious personal choices matter in the future of our warming planet? Warned about the perils of climate change, many of us now reduce, reuse, and recycle as a way of life, buy carbon offsets when we fly, and try to limit the energy guzzled by our home appliances and AC units. My guest today does all this and more. He doesn't drive, doesn't eat meat, he doesn't even own an air conditioner, although he also doesn't live in Texas. But while those gestures make him feel good as a citizen, as an economist at the Environmental Defense Fund, Gernot Wagner recognizes that they will never amount to enough to solve our problems. To really change the world, he says, we need to appeal to self-interest rather than self-sacrifice. He explains his ideas in his new book, But Will the Planet Notice? How Smart Economics Can Save the World. Gernot, welcome to Think.
Chris, good to be here.
Start, if you would, by talking about why the Environmental Defense Fund keeps an economist on staff.
Well, because we try to actually make the planet notice what we do. Mm-hmm. So EDF, long before my time actually, was one of the first environmental groups that hired a PhD economist. And we've had economists on staff now for at least a couple decades.
So a lot of us realize we can't change the world alone, but we figure we're at least making some kind of difference with our choices. Why doesn't it really matter if I take my own grocery bags to the store or buy only local food when I get there?
It matters. It matters to you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, keep recycling, keep walking to work, or biking to work, and mm-hmm. doing all the right things. But in addition to all of this, what we really need is policy change. Mainly because the individual actions, when you put them all together, they simply amount to, frankly, very little.
So if everybody did these things, it might matter more to the planet. But as an economist, you're not trained to count on people's altruistic impulses. You see the best motivator as self-interest.
Yes, and even, I guess, the larger point here is, even if Everyone who listens to this show, everyone who reads the book, everyone does the right things, it simply doesn't add up to enough. When you sort of, you know, crunch the numbers and look at what is truly necessary to fight global warming, it is much more daunting than simple recycling, simple, you know, giving up your car, giving up meat, for that matter, could possibly do. And that's the real difficulty. It is something collective that we ought to be doing. It is new technologies that we need to make that happen.
So going back to the plastic bag example, which I realize is relatively minor in the grand scheme of things, but, you know, we do this voluntarily here in some cases, but Ireland was able to cut the use of plastic bags by 90% within 3 months. How did they do that?
Through something called a plastax, mm-hmm. A tax, essentially, on plastic bags. Now, that sounds a lot worse than it is. It was a tiny, tiny fee, something like 20 euro cents, per plastic bag, which, frankly, something you don't notice that, right? You go to the grocery store and you spend $100 on your groceries. You don't notice these 20 cents.
Sure.
So, really, it shouldn't make a difference, right? This is the kind of small, annoying fee that you just end up paying, and, well, you get your plastic bag and you move on. Well, turns out that was not the case. Suddenly not getting a plastic bag, bringing your own canvas back to the store, became the new normal, and, well, Ireland managed to decrease plastic bags by 90%. Washington right now has these paper and plastic bag fees for both paper and plastic. And even though the program has only been in place for less than a year at this point, we still notice a huge difference. Suddenly not asking for the bag is the new normal, and the planet in this case does in fact notice.
What's so interesting about that, and it says something, I guess, about human nature and certainly our nature as creatures of the economy. A lot of stores here in Texas will give you a discount if you don't take the bag, but somehow avoiding a tax is a much bigger motivator than getting a little discount.
Yeah. Exactly, and the point is that the discount is tiny, right?
Yeah, it's like a nickel, a dime. Yeah,
yeah. So you stay at the store and you stay at the cash register, and someone offers you 10 cents back. You know, it's not even worth going back to the car, getting the canvas bag out of the trunk to save those 10 cents. Well, maybe not even to sort of unfold the canvas bag you just brought with you. It's 10 cents, right? Or a nickel, maybe. So that's the real problem. If the default is just getting the bag for free, well, you do it. Mm-hmm. If the default is paying 10 cents, well, initially, I guess, you get annoyed. And the second time around, you bring your own bag.
So part of what we're dealing with here is the way the economy is set up right now fails to account for the true costs of our actions as consumers. What sort of free ride do we get when, say, we buy gas for our cars or we use coal-generated power in our homes in terms of the costs that we're not having to compensate for?
That's exactly the right way of looking at this. So we do, in fact, privatize the benefits of much of what we do and socialize the costs. Right, so this basically led to the financial crisis a couple years ago and is clearly also at fault here. So when you look at coal power, for example, every ton of coal causes more than a ton of carbon dioxide emissions.
Hmm.
Every ton of carbon dioxide emissions causes about $20 worth of damage. So when you average it all out, these $20 per ton of CO2 emissions comes out to about 2 cents per kilowatt hour of electricity. It's not the world. It's not that significant, but it is. It obviously would change your choices that you make if you had to pay for those 2 cents a kilowatt hour.
So when you talk about that $20 worth of damage to, I guess it's human health and the environment and ecosystems, mm-hmm. people are going to be asking, well, where do you get that figure and who's paying it now if we're not having to pay for it?
Well, it turns out we are paying for it.
Mm-hmm.
We are just paying it with lives and our lungs and everything else. It's just that the person causing the pollution isn't paying it. People downwind, downstream are paying for that damage. And the $20 itself actually comes from a fairly boring appendix to an even more boring government report the Department of Energy put out that tries to measure exactly these effects. And of course, this wasn't the first time we came up with a number like this. This actually is based on years and years of research of economists trying to monetize, trying to put a dollar value on some of those damages.
And although I want to limit math in this program for people's benefit, $20 in damage for every ton of carbon dioxide pollution we pump into the air, the average American puts 20 tons out
yep.
there every year. And so it's $400 a year per American, but times 310 million people, that's a lot of damage.
Oh, yes, absolutely, it is. And we are paying for this, just not the one who does the polluting. So when I hop on a flight from New York to Dallas, I cause about, let's say, half a ton of damage, plus minus. So that's about $10 worth of damage. I don't notice that, or I don't pay for it. It's everybody else who pays fractions of a penny for that. And, of course, everyone else flying causes the same damage. Once you add it up, it adds up to quite a bit.
So let's talk about flying. I know this is something that you have to do often for your work, and I take it in some ways this pains you. There are people out there who choose to pay voluntary carbon offsets, not a majority of people, but certainly they're there. But you think this might actually have a counterintuitive effect in making us feel like we have permission to fly all over.
Up to a point, yes, exactly. So it makes you feel good. Why would airlines basically ask you to voluntarily pay those $15, $20 after you purchase the ticket? It is essentially to make you feel better about flying. That's a problem, to put it mildly.
And it's not as if we choose not to pay it, the airlines are digging into their pockets to pay the same amount of money.
Oh, of course not. Right? It's up to you to voluntarily pay those $20 per flight. I'm pretty sure a fair number of environmentalists do, in fact, do that. But first of all, it's a small fraction of the overall population who chooses to do this. So in that sense, the planet doesn't notice. And more importantly, it doesn't provide any incentives for the airlines whatsoever to do anything about their emissions. That's the real problem. It is now it's suddenly the consumer who chooses to go green, who buys the eco-friendly carry-on bag that's made with organic cotton and 60% post-consumer plastic or something along these lines. But, well, then you carry it on the plane and you fly with it.
Mm-hmm. So, obviously, if irresponsible environmental actions will have a cost, the question becomes, do we want to pay now or do we want to shift that cost until later? And clearly, right now, we're doing a lot of shifting. What are the best arguments for paying now?
I think because it's a lot cheaper. Mm-hmm. That is the best argument. Actually, aviation airlines is a pretty good example. Just today, the European Court of Justice issued a preliminary ruling saying that the EU's European Union's aviation directive, a way to make airlines pay for the emissions or hold airlines responsible for the emissions, does in fact have merit and will start on January 1st, 2012. So every plane going in and out of Europe and flying within Europe now has to face these collective policies that try to internalize costs, try to make flying a little bit more, like $10 a ticket, not that much more, a little bit more expensive to account for these costs and make consumers pay for the damage now as opposed to having society pay for it later on, having to pay much more.
And going back to the argument that you made earlier, if we don't each pay our fair share for whatever it is we consume, you really see this as a form of socialism because the rest of society is forced to pick that up.
Yeah, it is, right? It is privatizing benefits, socializing costs. It's everybody pays for the pollution, just not the one doing the polluting.
Why don't more free market champions see it this way? Is it because we've never had to pay it before?
Pretty much. And frankly, because when a lot of free market champions talk about free markets, it is a fairly distorted idea of what it means to have a free market. Financial system is one example, of course, of this, where bank bailouts at the end are, in fact, a form of socializing costs, a form of socialism. And now we are seeing the same thing, or we have been seeing the same thing with the planet, except, of course, a bailout isn't possible in this case.
So, in other words, if we wait till the last minute, it will, no matter how much money or how many resources we throw at the problem, we can't fix it.
It may be too late, yes.
Mm-hmm. Do these uncovered costs have an impact on the economy itself today?
They do, in fact, which is the really scary thing. So, for example, the Clean Air Act of 1970 increased GDP, gross domestic product, in 2010, last year, by about 1.5%. So this is fairly counterintuitive, right? So if you look at it, you have a regulation, the Clean Air Act, and GDP goes up because of it. And the effect is only through economic forces. This is not about, right, it's a bad thing that we are poisoning our children. That's not even included. What is included in this calculation is that not poisoning your children makes for more productive workers later on. And more productive workers later on lead to higher GDP. It's a purely economic argument in this case.
Gernot Wagner is my guest. He's an economist at the Environmental Defense Fund. He also teaches at Columbia University. His new book is called But Will the Planet Notice? How Smart Economics Can Save the World. We'd love to have your input on this conversation. You can get to us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Gernot Wagner. He's an economist at the Environmental Defense Fund. He also teaches at Columbia University. His new book is called But Will the Planet Notice? How Smart Economics Can Save the World. To be part of this conversation, you can call us on one of our open lines at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Okay, Gernot, let's say for the sake of this argument that we have established a policy that would collect back from Americans that average of $400 a year of damage that we do to the environment with all the CO2 we put into the air. If we were to collect that somewhere, first of all, who would collect it and how would we make appropriate decisions about how to apply that money?
Well, actually, the easiest way to apply that money is, in fact, just give it back. Give it back to everyone. Of course, not in equal amounts.
Uh-huh.
So you pay $400, say, because you emit exactly the average. You would get back $400. You would get back the equal amount. But now you emit, say, twice as much. You'd be paying more and still get back your $400 on average. So the ones who cause more pollution, the ones who cause more damage, pay more and, of course, are encouraged to then pollute less. The ones who pollute less gain financially because they actually get a bigger check back than they pay. So this isn't a way to raise money necessarily. This is a way to make polluters pay for the pollution that they cause.
Would incorporating the larger cost of consumption hurt the economy by encouraging thriftier behavior? And I'm not talking here strictly about energy, but about all the other things we buy and use and throw away.
Well, in the long run, right, over years and decades, like the Clean Air Act, it would actually benefit the economy because now suddenly you have healthier children, more productive workers, and, well, that's good for everyone, including GDP. In the short run, right, every regulation has costs. Otherwise, up to a point, we wouldn't need the regulation. If it was cheap or if it was completely free, everyone would be doing it already anyways. But really the point here is that if you pay these relatively small amounts, right, $400 a year, and you get back about as much money, well, that's money you have left in your pocket to spend again, except with the difference now that spending will no longer have this extra baggage of causing all that pollution damage that you are not paying for.
No one will argue that we in this country, in part because of our relatively high standard of living, consume more than pretty much any other population on Earth. Do we have some kind of obligation, and what sort of conflicts and questions do we get into if we think about compensating other places in the world that might pay the environmental cost of our consumption?
The obligation question is certainly a key one, and I guess as an economist, I can sidestep that easily and essentially say this is for others to decide. But yes, absolutely, right. There's some of that to the question, of course. Mm-hmm. The compensation issue, of course, is another very, very loaded question. And up to a point, of course, you could apply economics to this and say, well, actually, paying someone else to reduce emissions on your behalf, which is what some of these compensation systems are, makes everyone better off. It benefits the planet, or the planet doesn't notice in the sense because the pollution is being reduced somewhere. It benefits the one paying for having someone else reduce pollution because suddenly it's cheaper. Otherwise, you wouldn't be paying someone else to do this. And, of course, the one getting the money to be reducing pollution, well, benefits him too because otherwise, he wouldn't accept the money or reduce pollution in exchange.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now. We have Amar on the line in Irving. Hi, Amar.
Hi. My question is, when we talk about the cost of pollution, we normally talk about the consumer. That's billions of them. It's a very complicated calculations. Why don't we think about the source, like oil producing companies, oil mining companies, and just like in tobacco, we levy the tax on the tobacco companies, not the consumer. Essentially, the cost goes to the consumer, but then...
The consumer rather than the producer. Yeah, he was breaking up a little bit. Were you able to hear most of that, Gernot?
I was, yes. The short answer is that you would, in fact, imply the tax or the limit on emissions at a very high level, right? It's not that everyone, the 300 million of us, are basically facing some regulatory burden or something along these lines suddenly. It is, of course, the oil company, the coal company, the airline, ultimately paying the cost to the government. That's where the tax is being collected. This is where the fee applies. But of course, like you said, for tobacco, for example, right, it comes down to the smoker to be paying for that pack of cigarettes a bit extra. The same happens here.
I guess it makes sense, too, to go at the corporate level because they're the ones who have the power to buy different equipment or to change their practice so that they're emitting less.
Yes, exactly. Right. And it comes back to the airline example again. If you voluntarily pay for pay a bit extra for your flight, the airline wouldn't notice the difference here. If the airline pays, well, suddenly it makes sense to buy more fuel-efficient planes.
So let's talk about cap and trade, because this is such a politically loaded phrase these days that a lot of people are talking about simply renaming it to something else. But you remind us here that we have used it in this country quite successfully to get rid of leaded gasoline.
We did, yes. It was part of the lead phase-out in the 80s already. We used cap and trade or a version of it for a couple of years. And what it led to was a decrease that was much, much faster and cheaper than anyone ever anticipated. And in fact, lead in gasoline is gone at this point. We're no longer talking about a phase down. It's a phase out.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Tony in Dallas. Hi, Tony.
Hi, how are you, Chris?
Great, thank you.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Very interested in what Mr. Wagner has to say. I actually teach environmental sustainability at SMU, and we do talk about economics and energetics, both in my course. I don't know, Mr. Wagner, whether you're making the argument that you can't get people to do the right thing without a price signal, or that that is really the only efficient way to get them to do it.
Excellent question, Tony, and it is a bit of both. You can get some of us, right, the environmentalists out there, well, we already do the right thing. But first of all, that doesn't add up to enough. That's one. So it is much more efficient to try to do the right thing if it doesn't just do good but also makes you do well because of it. And more to the point, some of these individual actions may actually be counterproductive. Right? So come back to the plane example again. If you voluntarily pay $20 for the flight, and if this now makes you feel good about flying, you may actually be doing more of it. That's a real problem. So in this case, the voluntary action may in fact be counterproductive. It is the policy that makes the real difference.
So we've talked a lot, particularly in the last election cycle, about the value of green jobs, and that turns out to be sort of an amorphous term. But can you talk a little bit about whether there are definitely business sectors and industries that stand to make money if we increase the price of much of our consumption?
Absolutely. There are. So clearly there are sort of these obvious choices, right? There's when you make oil more expensive, well, alternatives to oil will benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Wind energy, very prominent in Texas, will clearly benefit. Now, on the other hand, of course, green jobs, like you mentioned, a pretty amorphous term, it goes throughout the economy. Weatherizing homes, insulating, installing more efficient air conditioners, doing all these things clearly employs people. Every windmill has about 100 tons of steel in it. Someone needs to produce that steel. There are lots and lots of jobs in this. Now, green jobs, like you mentioned, is in fact a very loaded term. But at the end of the day, it is one way to get our economy out of this recession, trying to look to green jobs, trying to look to jobs that don't just prolong the problem we are currently in, a pollution problem, but actually try to make a real difference as one way out of this dual mess, the environmental and the economic problem.
Gernot Wagner is my guest. His new book is called But Will the Planet Notice? How Smart Economics Can Save the World. We'll go back to the phones now. This time we have Jim on the line in Louisville. Hello, Jim.
Yes, hi. Really interested in the program today, and I'd like to thank Mr. Weber for Wagner for presenting it. I've been working on the petroleum side of this for a long time, very similar thoughts, and even with my congressman who seems to be a little resistant to anything that would improve it. But I agree that you can put a tax on gasoline, for example, and redistribute it, which is really a good idea. But in addition to that, it would seem that for light-duty vehicles, which is responsible for the biggest percentage of our petroleum usage, that putting a price on inefficient vehicles and then giving a credit to people who buy efficient ones at a break-even point, you know, so that you would encourage the people who are causing the problem to pay for the people who are trying to solve the problem,
mm-hmm.
Would be an additional incentive to, which we know works basically from the price of gasoline when it went up to $4. People changed their policies as far as what they bought and how they drove.
Absolutely.
And also, cash for clunkers showed that people would, in fact, buy a more efficient vehicle if they were given incentives. So those two things suggest that we've already got the evidence, and the technology is there already. Let's say we keep talking about new technology, and the technology is there because we've got vehicles that use 10 gallon per 100 miles and vehicles that use 1 gallon per 100 miles. So,
yeah, I think we got your point. Gernot, what do you think?
I couldn't agree more. It is, and it goes to the key point here, that voluntary action simply isn't enough. We have the technologies already. They would pay to deploy, but not enough people are doing it, and it needs to be something collective. It needs to be a policy change that does make that happen.
How does Europe's emissions trading system work?
It is a way to limit, cap emissions mm-hmm. overall from about 40% of overall emissions from the EU. Then the companies in that system get allowances, get essentially permissions to pollute, if you want to call it that. And that trading, that flexibility, ensures that the cheapest possible emission reductions are achieved as quickly as possible. And it's been working very well so far. Emissions are down in Europe, one because of the recession, of course, but in almost equal parts because of the European emissions trading system.
How would fuel efficiency standards for cars or CAFE standards play into this equation? You have some really interesting information in the book.
They're actually, what Jim just mentioned, they're sort of a complement to all of this.
Mm-hmm.
So turns out when you or I walk into the car dealership and we see a more fuel-efficient car, we are willing to pay about 60 cents more for every dollar in fuel savings later. Right, that's a pretty good good trade-off right here. So we are, in fact, willing to pay a bit more now for those savings later, but we're not willing to pay the $1 now
right.
for $1 of savings, right? Which would be the, if you ask the straight-up economist, that would be the quote-unquote rational thing to do. Now, CAFE standards try to get at this problem. They essentially try to make cars available that are better for everyone, better for the planet, better for the consumer, and allow you to drive the, like, have the option of driving the more fuel-efficient car and save money later on because of those CAFE standards.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Paul in Farmers Branch writes, "It sounds like a carbon tax would be a fair and efficient method of implementing the economic forces you suggest. What are the downsides of this approach, such as gaming the system?"
Well, for a carbon tax, well, there are always, always people who evade taxes. There are always people who try to evade the system, sure. So enforcement, of course, needs to be a key component of this. But either with a tax or with, for example, the European emissions trading system, with a, I know it's a dirty word, but with a with a cap and trade system, the key point there in many ways is that it doesn't just tax people, it creates opportunities. So you have lots of people wanting to be part of this because they truly benefit.
So essentially, you're saying to companies, it's up to you. You can keep doing things the old way, but it's going to cost you, or you can upgrade and save yourself and potentially even earn some money.
Exactly. And, well, you mentioned the leaded gasoline example before. There's actually a much larger and possibly even more successful example in the 90s. Remember acid rain?
Yeah.
Well, I don't actually, because we pretty much solved the problem in the 90s, and we did it through a system very much like this, the cap and trade system. And the acid rain trading system saw almost 100% compliance.
Hmm.
If anything, we saw over-compliance, companies doing more than was necessary.
Gernot Wagner is my guest. He's an economist at the Environmental Defense Fund, and he teaches at Columbia University. His new book is called But Will the Planet Notice? How Smart Economics Can Save the World. You can be part of our conversation now by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Gernot Wagner, who is an economist at the Environmental Defense Fund and author of the new book, But Will the Planet Notice? How Smart Economics Can Save the World. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. We should point out that you're not only talking about energy use here. You've also looked at how smart economic policy has helped sustain fisheries in different parts of the world. Can you give us some examples of that?
It is pretty much a fairly similar system, let's put it that way, that does the right thing here.
Mm-hmm.
It is trying to make everyone realize that fish out in the sea are only a free resource just for the taking, but that we do in fact need to be responsible for managing that resource responsibly. And once you do that, fisheries, whether it's the Alaskan halibut fishery or fisheries in the Gulf, Mexico, or off the coast of New England, do surprisingly well. What it comes down to is making sure that someone is ultimately responsible for managing that fishery.
We have an email here from Randy that points out farmers in the Dust Bowl were skeptical of and resistant to adopting soil conservation techniques until the government began paying them a small fee, about $1 per acre, to do so. Interesting example there.
Mm-hmm. That's another example, right? It's along the same lines. doing good by doing well is often the best way of going about trying to make the planet notice.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Steve in Fort Worth. Hi, Steve.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
I had a question for him. If just one of the things that the if we put certain levies on or taxes on U.S. production companies, how can we ensure that they are not going to move their production to China or countries like that where they're going to just wholeheartedly abuse the economy, and so overall the environment's worse off than before we put these limits in effect?
Good question, and it turns out we actually have quite a bit of experience with this, and it shows that environmental policy overall has very little effect on companies moving overseas. There are lots of other factors that play a much more important role, cheaper labor costs and so on. Environmental policy barely registers here. Even though there are, of course, ways to even ensure sort of the small effects that do happen and make sure that that they don't happen. So, for example, when you make energy costs increase by a bit in this country, there is a danger of a company just moving across the border and trying to sell the products back in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one way of ensuring that that's not the case is do something like charge a tariff of sorts to level the playing field, so anyone selling the same product in the U.S. Faces the same costs.
Back to the phones now. This time we have another Steve on the line, this time from ULIS. Hey, Steve.
Thank you very much, Chris, and a wonderful conversation. I'm right on board, but part of me is a pessimist based on human nature. I'm sure that there was a lobby on Easter Island, a coalition between the loggers and the lumber owners, you know, trying to cut down that last tree to preserve jobs and keep the GDP up. And human nature being what it is about, not reacting until things are too late, unless you have an educated populace with a group interest. And I note that in Europe, they are rather much more enlightened in certain ways, that the health of their population is important because the population pays for it with single-payer governmental health care, and that they're all in the same basket on land that's been lived on for thousands of years. And here with the economic crisis and fear and a lot of money, I don't know that the population is enlightened. So how do we keep encouraging people to get on board?
Thanks for your call. You're not...
Well, Steve, we need a lot more people like you who do realize that this is the way to go. But more to the point, it comes back again to trying to make policy change happen that makes it in the economic interest of everyone to do the right thing. We can't trust that everyone is doing the right thing suddenly overnight, doing it enough to make the planet notice here. So, yes, we do need policy change to make it in everyone's self-interest to be doing the right thing.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Harvey calling from Wiley. Hi, Harvey.
How you doing, Chris?
Very well, thank you.
When you talked about the incident in Ireland, I had to smile. I'm involved in film and foam plastic recycling right now. That's very similar to your $20 on the flight ticket,
mm-hmm.
because what happened is you took about 2 or 3% of the film plastic that their person is going to process at the grocery store, and you made them feel good about everything else by taking that 2 or 3% away, because everything that you buy at the grocery store is film or is some form of film plastic and foam.
Yeah,
and so, you know, you're not highlighting the problem. You're masking it. And the other point I like to make is some of us believe that altruism and cultural wisdom are the two greatest motivators that we have, and some people believe that everything has to move by the dollar. And I think that's about it.
Thanks for calling. Do you want to respond to that, Gernot?
Harvey, sure. So you're absolutely right about the first example. So yes, there are ways to decrease plastic bag use, but if you're really concerned about plastic overall, well, we need a way to look at the whole picture here. And the altruism versus self-interest question, like Chris mentioned in the introduction, right? So I don't drive, I don't have an air conditioner and all these things, right? I'd love to think that it is altruism that makes the difference here. Unfortunately, at the end of the day, it is money that makes the world go round.
Why are those choices important for you to make personally in your own life, even if you know that it might not have any impact because it's an individual action?
I guess, well, let's put it that way. Every 12-year-old, every kid is an environmentalist to a point, right? Mm-hmm. I just never grew up. that's really the it's the cop-out answer here, but doing the right thing does in fact make you feel good, right? It is a good thing to be doing the right thing. So reducing, reusing, recycling, turning down plastic bags and so on, it all does make a difference to you personally. Once again, of course, when it comes to actually making a difference, actually making the planet notice, that's a different story.
How important is it from the perspective of economics and the way that economics works that we leave people a choice? So in other words, you can have all the plastic bags that you want. You can, you know, have all the electricity you want. You're just going to have to pay for it, as opposed to saying we have banned a certain product or service or activity.
Well, here's the counterexample to this smart way of approaching plastic bags. San Francisco, in fact, banned plastic bags.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so I mean, you can just imagine how this plays out. You now have this underground economy of plastic bag peddlers on the street corner trying to sell these illegal substances, right? And now, clearly, it's a plastic bag, right? So that's not what's going to happen. But in this case, you did reduce the choice.
Mm-hmm.
You just said no plastic bags at all. Well, it turns out sometimes it is a pretty good thing to have a plastic bag around. Right, it rains outside, you have some valuable groceries you want to protect. Well, it's good to have the option of opting for the plastic bag after all. Or maybe you're using it as a trash bag at home, mm-hmm. for that matter, right? So the ban limits options. The small fee in this case says, hey, if you're willing to pay the fee, if you're willing to ask for the plastic bag, thou shalt receive. It's just that the default value, like the island and the Washington example show, suddenly is not to ask for the plastic bag, and plastic bag use goes down by 80-90%.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have James calling from Fort Worth. Hello, James.
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call,
ma'am.
I love your show. I listen to it all the time. My question for your guest is just that there's a huge amount of power and influence, money, that is really dedicated to keeping things the way they are right now. And we see this, you know, in like, for instance, with the Tea Party, that they would use, you know, the fear of raising taxes, the Republican Party, to really influence, you know, our decisions about how we actually approach a problem, you know, that is so important, like energy and conservation. Because there's so much money in our system and it really does affect the political discourse, I mean, how do we combat that? Because everyone kind of would agree that it's in our best interest to have energy independence and to pollute the environment less. But there's just such a strong array of forces that are really, really lined up against it.
Is there an economic answer to that, Gernot?
Well, I can throw a couple numbers at you.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out the last congressional fight we had about the climate bill, it was the case that the fossil fuel lobby outspent environmentalists and the clean energy lobby by about 10 to 1. So, yes, there's a lot of money at stake here. Now, the last battle like this playing out in the U.S. was in California, where it was about California's cap-and-trade system and the continuation of it, And in that case, the clean energy proponents outspent the fossil fuel lobby 3-1. So clearly there's a lot of money at stake here, but there's also money on either side. So of course what has to happen, or what we need to have happen, is that the money on the clean energy side at some point prevails nationally as well.
So it also sounds like as consumers we ought to vote with the way we spend our dollars.
Yes, exactly. So spending your dollars wisely, of course, is always a good choice. But at the end of the day, that's the first step, calling your congressman, making sure that the right policies are in place is at least as, and I would argue, much more important.
In terms of getting the rest of the world on board, because clearly, just as no one person can do it alone, no one country can do it alone, even the EU, with all the changes it's made, you point out that to make a substantial difference in the quality of the environment, we don't actually have to get the entire world on board immediately. It's enough to start with the U.S., the EU, and the BRICS countries.
Yes. So, right, so BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China. So the countries that matter at the end of the day, the large polluters that need to be on board here. And yes, right, it's not 193 countries here that need to come to a unanimous agreement. It's the European Union and 5-6 other countries.
Can you speak to this? Is there something so very culturally different about, say, the EU from the United States, where the standards of living are quite similar, but the approach to environmental regulation is so different?
When I pull out my Austrian passport, I do sometimes wonder about the U.S. situation. But then again, when I pull out my U.S. passport and look at the European situation, it is different. There are cultural differences, of course. But what really makes the difference in Europe right now is the exact same approach that could or would work here in the U.S., which is making sure that going green actually pays for you personally as well.
Do you have any evidence that you're winning over the free market stalwarts?
It depends who you call free market, right? Mm-hmm. If it's the free market radicals who essentially just cover their ears and don't want to hear anything about this, that's a different story. Having the conversation already is fairly difficult. But there are clearly lots of people out there who are interested in making markets work better. And in this case, this is the biggest thing we can do to make markets work better.
Gernot Wagner's new book is called But Will the Planet Notice? How Smart Economics Can Save the World. Gernot, it's been such an interesting hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.